gotta live for yourself and nobody else. You gotta live for yourself and nobody else. And nobody else, you gotta live for yourself and nobody else.
Yes, a James Brown tune, If I'll Go Crazy. But that wasn't James Brown singing. I don't know. Does anybody know? I should have made that a mystery record. Let me see if the caller on the phone line can tell me who sang I'll Go Crazy. Who was singing I'll Go Crazy? Can you tell me who sang that?
Yeah, I know who sang that. That was Dennis Tufano from the Buckinghams.
Wow, how'd you know that?
Well, because I happen to be him.
Oh! As we welcome Dennis Tufano to the Relics of Rarity show here on Sunday nights, and of course,
thank you.
And we do want to thank Gary Miller. I know that Gary Miller was lighting up your Twitter there. Wait, that sounds almost perverted.
Yeah, lighting up one's Twitter, especially with today's laws, is you got to watch where you do that.
Right. So I went to the phone book. I couldn't find it. I called the operator. I said, "Operator, Dennis Tufano, please. Lives probably in either L.A. or Tri-Chicago." And bingo, there was your number. And it's just amazing how you could find somebody.
These days it's not that hard.
But let me welcome Dennis Tufano, who was the lead singer on every Buckingham record that ever came out.
Oh yeah.
And of course, in the early days of the Buckinghams, you guys kind of had an interesting story behind the Buckinghams, because you covered, I guess, I'll Go Crazy was the first record to ever hit any kind of a Billboard or national chart. It peaked at number 115 on Billboard, and right. I imagine Dennis got a lot more airplay out in the Chicago area.
Well, that was the launch of it. Yeah, the WLS radio there, Dick Biondi and all those guys. He was one of the main launchers of all the local bands out there. He got our records played and got them out to that 50,000 watt station, so that we picked up a lot of fans. Yeah, I'll Go Crazy was a song that I found on James Brown's Live at the Apollo album, and I was a big James Brown fan, so I took it to the band and I said, "Look at it." I said, "We were doing a lot of ballrooms and dances, back in 65 and 66. I said, this would be a great song for us to do." And we worked it up as in part of our live show, and it really it knocked people out all the time. It really got a lot of attention. So that's when they said, "Look, you guys should make a record, and I think one of them should be I'll Go Crazy." So we recorded it, and they released it, and it gave us some national recognition.
Who was some of the early guys that really helped get you guys a recording contract? I know the name comes up, and maybe you can explain how he comes into this. Carl Bonafede.
Yeah, Carl Bonafede. Carl Bonafede was a DJ at the dances. He used to play spin the records at some of the ballrooms, and he was kind of like a unofficial promotion man. When he latched on to some local talent, he really like pushed hard, So he actually became kind of like our first manager. He took us down to the suit store, and got us all the same suits. And he recognized when we were working at a place called the Holiday Ballroom in Chicago, which has since been torn down. It was a stalwart place that all of us young kids used to go and dance and listen to live music. And we started playing there in our early days. And he heard us. He was there spinning records, and he noticed that about halfway into our set that everybody stopped dancing and started standing in front of the stage and watching us. And he said, that's unusual for a ballroom gig. And he said, maybe there's something special going on here. You should probably make a record. And that's pretty much how, then he introduced us to Dan Belloc, who was a big band producer and saxophone player. And he liked our sound. And so we went in and recorded. We did I'll Go Crazy, Kind of a Drag, a couple of other tunes on that session. They brought us down to Chess Records at 2120 South Michigan Avenue. And so we recorded in a very legendary place. And there was a special sound, though, kind of a magic to that place, too. And Ron Malo was the engineer there. He was amazing. He did a lot of work with all the Stones recorded there, the Yardbirds. It was the place that all the English bands wanted to come to record because of the blues.
In fact, I remember when the Stones were here in America, they got turned on to the Valentinos, which is the Womack brothers and Bobby right. Womack's dad. They had recorded, of course, originally It's All Over Now, and the Stones loved it so much that they also ended up booking some time down there at Chess Recording Studios, and of course they covered the song It's All Over Now. And I think this time in 1964, right around August of 64, they actually, came on the charts with their version of that Valentino yeah. song. So you're right, a lot of people yeah. love recording down there at Chess Studios.
Oh, yeah. Well, when the Stones were there, they loved it so much that there's an instrumental on one of their albums, tracks that were recorded there, and one is called 2120 South Michigan Avenue. And it's an instrumental that they did in honor of the studio.
Wow.
It was a great little place, a funky little room, very small. It was eight tracks, a little reel-to-reel in the wall. It really, there was no sophisticated equipment there at all, and there were no sliders on the mixing board. There were big black round knobs. It was like looking at an old science project. It was amazing, and Ron Malo made it sound unbelievable with that kind of equipment. Nowadays there's so much equipment that you can make any sound happen, but they did that on eight tracks did a great job.
Now, some of those early Buckingham tunes were garagey, weren't they?
Oh yeah, we're a pretty local band, and we played together for like about 2 years before we recorded. So we had a pretty good sound going into the studio that was kind of natural and organic. And then we were very lucky and fortunate to get Jim Holvey, who was the guitar player in a great show band in Chicago called The Mob. And he's the one that wrote Kind of a Drag and co-wrote Don't You Care, Hey Baby, and Susan with Gary Beesver, who was the sax player in The Mob. And he also, on our first album, on our Kind of a Drag album for USA Records, we also did about five songs that Jim Holvey wrote, too. And they kind of something about his writing and matching up with us just became a very raw kind of listening back to that Kind of a Drag album. It's so basic and so simple that you can hear every note, every string, and everything that's played on it. And it's very garagey, very, 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 I think, organic sounding.
And of course, one of the tunes that a lot of my garage listeners request a lot, I want to play it right now, and then you can tell us about it. It's a tune called I've Been Wrong Before. So let's give it a listen, and then you can tell me. If you remember that song, you could talk about
yeah.
I've Been Wrong Before. But let's give it a listen right now.
Sure.
great garage sounder of the Buckinghams there. I've been wrong before. That was definitely right out of the garage. That was a unique sound because you never really continued that particular sound. I guess the Buckinghams started to go in a little bit of a different way after that one.
Well, you know, we kind of followed the material that we were getting, too. I mean, I've Been Wrong was actually a Hollies song that we covered.
Really?
We were big fans of the Hollies with their harmonies and everything, and their strong guitar sound that they had. And we covered that song, but our cover is a little harder edged, you know, because of, you know, that's kind of who we were in the early days. I mean, there was a crossover between the kind of street sound that coming out of Chicago and then the British invasion. The Beatles really introduced a softer kind of sound to things and yet still maintained a good rock kind of attitude. So we kind of were in a transitional phase, really, because the album, we didn't cut the album all at once. We did like four sides and then three sides. So the album actually represented probably about 9 months of time. So as we progressed into another sound, we started transitioning into another sound. And then by the time we came out of the USA deal and signed with Columbia Records, Jim Holley handed us "Don't You Care" and "Susan," and that they were a little bit different sound. It softened our sound. Gave us that R&B jazz flavored soul to it, and I think that was part of the thing, because the Mob band that Jimmy was in was more of an R&B show band. So I think his chord structures and his voicings were a little bit more R&B-ish, which gave us a different pop sound than the other pop bands, I think, you know, which I think gave us a little edge for sounding a little bit different than everybody else.
What was it, Jim Holvey or Carl Bonifetti? Who was sort of instrumental in the decision that you guys needed to take on a name and a look so that people would think that you were part of the British invasion? And how important do you think that was, looking back?
Well, you know, it's at that time it was kind of like a free-for-all, because music was changing and the British invasion was so... it was a monster, really. I mean, it changed everything. We were in what happened, our band used to be called the Pulsations. Back in the early 60s, you had to have a band name that sounded like you were moving, you know, something that had some action to it. And because we played a lot of dances and a lot of places like that. So we were called the Pulsations. And that came about at a dance once where we didn't have a name for the band. We were just a bunch of guys. And somebody said, "Wow, you got such a pulsating sound." So we just called ourselves the Pulsations after that. And we won a battle of the bands in 1965 for a local TV show.
Who did you beat out? Do you remember?
One of the bands was Denny and the Decades. And I think it was the beginnings of, might have been the Ides of March. I mean, all of us, all the guys, the bands in Chicago coming up at the time, like we were all part of different, you know, names of bands. You know, the Pulsations became the Buckinghams, and Denny and the Decades. Some of those guys then became another band, and then the American Breed and the Ides of March. So it was we were always competing against each other during that period of time.
And what was the TV show that you were on? Because if you don't say it...
It was called All Time Hits, and what they did was they had exactly what the title was. They had all the hits from different genres of music, Broadway, standards. They had, you know, kind of harmony like the Freshmen, or I mean, it was, and we were the rock part of the show, and during the rehearsals when we were, and it was all live, it was very interesting because it was very, you know, primitive in those days to record live stuff on TV. 1965, they really didn't even have good microphones, but they asked us in rehearsals. They said, "Look, because of the British invasion, do you think that you can change your name to sound a little bit more English sounding, to add a flavor to it?" And we said, "Hey, look, it's fine with us, because, you know, the Pulsations were just a local live band, and it didn't really matter if we changed our name." And so we said, "We'll think about it." And the next day in rehearsals, a security guard who had overheard this request, who had kind of longish hair for 1965, he kind of walked up to us and said, "Look, I heard what they said last night. I made a list of names for you guys. to look at. And we looked at the list, and there were some really great names on there. But the one that jumped out was the Buckinghams.
Do you remember what name came in second?
Oh, yeah. The Baker Street Irregulars was one of the ones that we were going to, because we liked the whole Sherlock Holmes thing.
Well, I'm glad you picked the Buckinghams.
Yeah, it was a bit wordy. But there was other ones like that, you know, like the Carnaby Streeters, and little things. But the Buckinghams hit us because, well, obviously the Palace, Buckingham Palace. But in Chicago, we have a very, very a landmark fountain in Grant Park called Buckingham Fountain. And it's a big, gigantic, some French copy of a gigantic fountain that has colors come out of it all the time. It's like a landmark. It's been there forever. So we thought, this would be great. We keep one foot in Chicago with the Buckingham Fountain, and we'll please the show with an English-sounding name, and we still have the best of both worlds. Matter of fact, our Kind of a Drag album cover, our very first album, in the background is Buckingham Fountain.
Uh-huh.
So that's why we kept it together by saying, okay, the Buckingham Fountain still relates to Chicago, so we call ourselves that. And then what happened later is that nobody really thought of us as being English until we actually started doing national TV shows. And it was the Smothers Brothers show that we did, where we arrived and Tommy came out to welcome us. And he says, well, we're so glad you didn't come on the show. We're really big fans. And we said, well, thanks. It's great to be here. We're big fans of you. And he goes, wait a second. You don't have English accents. We said, no, we have Chicago accents. So, you know, and he says, oh, we thought you were English because we made this big set with all the Union Jack flags. And we looked at it, and there was a gigantic set of Union Jacks, you know. And we said, well, that's okay. He said, no, we got to change it. He said, no, that's ridiculous. It's so, we're taping today. We can't do that. We'll just leave it there. We got another song with another set. So we did Mercy, Mercy with that background. Well, on the Smothers Brothers show, they don't interview the bands. So nobody ever heard us talk. They just heard us sing the song. So from that show, because of the Union Jacks behind us, everywhere we went, as soon as we arrived, everybody thought we were English, and which was fun. I mean, we didn't. A couple of times we pretended to have English accents and had fun with people, but then we let them know we weren't. But it was. I think it helped because of the British invasion. I think that there was a certain amount of
it couldn't hurt
cachet to it. Yeah, I mean, it worked out fine for us, and it was kind of a sophisticated name. And it kind of gave us an aura in the band of being, kind of like we dressed very neatly. And, you know, we were kind of a clean-looking band, and I think the name kind of fit, you know.
You guys, of course, I want to play your big hit. I know my listeners, of course, this is a radio station where it's weird because a lot of stations I've been on, you better play the hits or you're fired. Top Shelf Oldies. Yeah. This is a station where they love the uncommon things. But I want to play your big hit of Kind of a Drag because I'm going to ask you about that. I know that there's a great story behind this. So let's give a listen right now to the one that really, the breakout record for the Buckinghams, Kind of a Drag.
Baby, don't love you. Kind of a drag when you know she's been untrue. Oh, listen, cause you want I gotta say that you girl. Like you wanna cry. Oh, girl, even though you made me feel blue, I still love you.
Buckingham and Kind of a Drag. And, you know, of course, that song, I love the song, but I have to tell you, I was a Met season ticket holder. And there were the years when the Mets were just awful. And that song always got played every time the Mets lost a game. Kind of a Drag.
That's funny. But, well, you know, it was a great, I mean, what a common phrase anyway. I mean, people say it all the time to me all the time, and then they realize that they're saying the title of our song. You know?
Yeah, that was written by Jim Holvey, I think you said. Is that right? Or
right, Jim Holvey, we were doing a Dick Clark, he had these big weekend concert fests in Chicago, and we were at the Chicago Stadium, and all the local bands got to go into the afternoon slots for showcasing our bands, you know, and then at night they would have the bigger acts, you know, the more famous acts. So we were there doing our show, and Carl Bonafetti went up to Jim Holvey and said, because they were the Dick Clark backup band too, and he said, look at it, have you heard the Buckinghams, you know, and stuff, and he said, yeah, they're really good, they got a good sound. He said, do you think you got any songs or anything for them? And he goes, you know, I do have a couple of songs. He says, I've got one song in particular that, because Jim was writing for many years and stuff for his band. And he said, there's a song that I've written that it probably won't be suitable for my band, but he says, I'll give it to you guys and see what you can do with it. So he went up to the hotel room, and he took a little acoustic guitar out and played on this little 3-inch reel-to-reel recorder and just sang and played the song very basically. And we took the little tape and took it in the basement, listened to it, and came up with a good arrangement for it. And then we used to play it live, and it used to get a great response. And so we recorded it, but the record company didn't like the song, and they kept holding it back and releasing other songs off our album and stuff. And they would get a little bit of noise, but they weren't really like flying off the racks.
You're talking about songs like "I Call Your Name," for example.
Yeah, "I Call Your Name" was also a local regional hit. "I Call Your Name," "I've Been Wrong" was released as a single. "I Call Your Name," "I'll Go Crazy," and they all got us in there, and they gave us, you know, shut off different little areas of our abilities and stuff, and what we thought about music. But Kind of a Drag just had a special thing about it. It gave us chills at the end of recording it, and so at the end of the contract, strangely enough, they said, okay, we've only got one side left, so we're going to release it. We'll release Kind of a Drag, and we're going to release you from the contract till you're done. And we said, wow, okay, fine. So they released the record, and luckily, the radio stations in the Midwest had picked up on all of our other single releases. So since this one was released, they had no promotion behind it because they didn't like the record. It just went off to the radio stations. And that was November of 66. And by February of 67, it was number one with a bullet, Billboard.
And somebody at USA Records probably shot themselves in the head.
Well, you know, from what people told us, they didn't always... their bookkeeping was very, very creative, let's put it that way. So I don't know if they cared or about that at all. But they definitely, we never heard from them after that, you know, and we didn't really look back, because what happened then was that Kind of a Drag went to number one, and we didn't even know that we were actually, our keyboard player left to become a doctor, and so it was the four of us sitting in the basement of Nick, the bass player, and we're going to audition keyboard players and stuff like that, and all of a sudden, John Polis, the manager, I'm not the manager, the drummer, who actually started the band, it was his band, he walks in and throws Billboard on the table and opens it up, and Kind of a Drag was number one with a bullet. We had no record label, we had no manager, we had no keyboard player, but we had a number one record.
I guess the question then is, did you ever, you didn't have a lot of things, but did you ever get paid, or did you ever make any money on Kind of a Drag? Because I had heard from another fellow USA recording artist that maybe I won't mention at the time. I heard that USA recording artist, that label, you know, had a lot of, you know, like a lot of record companies back then, there was a lot of mob influence, and it was almost like a place to launder money and take a tax write-off.
Yeah, we were told a lot that the cost of manufacturing the records ate up a lot of the money. and that we didn't sell enough. Matter of fact, the when the RIAA came in to get us register us for a gold record, because Kind of a Drag was on the charts for 3 weeks at number one, and it obviously sold a lot, and so they went in to get an accounting, and the record label allegedly undersold the record so they wouldn't have to pay us, so that we didn't get a gold record. And they came back to us and said, look, we think that you should go in there and audit that record company, because we think that you sold enough records to get a gold record.
The fact that you're still alive, does that mean you didn't ask for the audit?
No, we did ask for the audit.
Okay.
So you have to realize that that four of us in the band were Italians also.
Well, plus Nick is a pretty tough-looking guy.
Oh, Nick, yeah. Nick, well, you know, we also had... friends and family that looked out for us.
Okay.
And so nobody really messed with us about that, but we did audit them, and because the gold record was 500,000 copies, and when we audited them after the fact, we found out that it was 750,000 copies were sold, and then by the time that the audit was taken and we had an attorney come in to try to get our money, the record company was gone. And which was very typical. They were almost like little kiosk record companies. Of course, USA Records was there for a very long time, but I think that the time, the 65-66 time period, was probably their transitional time, where they were kind of lost in the past and didn't move forward. So they kind of, I think they just closed down so they wouldn't have to pay bills.
I mean, they had a lot of great R&B came out on that label as well.
Oh yeah, well they were right there. I mean, USA Records was like just doors away from Chess Records. So when we used to go in there, you'd walk down the hall and there'd be all these unbelievable blues artists with their records on the walls and stuff and everything. And yeah, they did a lot of work. I mean, they were actually a very good label for Chicago, for a local label. And but I think like some business goes, you know, somebody in the company started going a little left field, and that changes things, you know.
And just for the record collectives that do listen to my show, just the first record that the Buckinghams ever did, was that actually the Sweets for My Sweet on Spectrasound, was it?
Yes, it is. Spectrasound was just a virtual label. It was Dan Belloc who was the band leader, and they just needed to put out a record. What we do is we used to do Sweets for My Sweet in our live show. And this was recorded, especially for the collectors. This is a great story, because it was done on a two-track stereo machine, and there was one microphone hanging in the middle of the room. And they put the two vocals. At the time, I was singing with a guy named George McGrow. He was one of the original singers of the band early on, and we did a lot of duet stuff, Righteous Brothers, Everly Brothers, you know, anything that had harmonies in it, we did it. And so they put the singer closest to the mic, they put the drummer way in the back of the room, and then they had the guitar player move his amp around until they got the right mix. And so everything on Sweets for My Sweet was a live, no mix. It was just a live show. And it was unbelievable, because... there was no mixing involved, and once you recorded it, that's what you got. And
was it just one take?
It was a couple of takes. It was a couple of takes until they got the blend,
okay,
you know, that they wanted. And and that's pretty much really what happened to it. Then is once we got the blend, then they pushed record, and that was it. And there was no changes.
Well, I've got the record in my collection. Do you have it still in your collection, Dennis?
Yes, I do. Yes, okay. I do.
Yeah, I'm a record collector. I don't know if you know that, but I have over 100,000 plus, you know, original label 45s.
God bless you, Dave. Gee.
So if you're ever looking for a record, although I'm still trying to figure out, when I saw you perform, you did this great Bobby Darin tune, like a really cool Bobby Darin, you know, rocker. You do a lot of Bobby Darin, because I know obviously he's a big influence for you.
It was a
blues
number. Fan of his in high school. Oh, the blues number, Funny What Love Can Do. Yeah, he wrote that song. I found that because I do a Bobby Darin tribute show where I do a whole timeline from him from the beginning to the very end, and we do from the rock and roll to the blues to the country to the folk, and then into the standards and all that, and they'll end with the Las Vegas, you know, portion of his life, and it's, for a singer, you couldn't ask for a better songbook. I mean, there's so much material there, and he had such a great style. You know, he really brought a lot of his personality to almost all of the music he did. So, and yeah, the funny what love can do. I mean, I was a harp player to begin with. I played harmonica in the band early on. That's how I got in the union, playing harmonica. So when I heard the Funny What Love Can Do, and Bobby Darin played harmonica too, so I was really attracted to the stuff. But the combination of Chicago blues and his stuff, I started doing Funny What Love Can Do in my act, and it's a great song. It's just a great straight-ahead blues song, you know.
And by the way, for those of you who have not seen Dennis Stefano in concert, I know he's going to be in Huntington, West Virginia. I believe it's an outdoor show. It's free.
Outdoor Italian Fest, yeah. There'll be good food. And, you know, a lot of pretty women, because it's an Italian fest.
And pretty women, I should tell you, I'm a straight guy, but, you know, ladies, Dennis is one heck of a good-looking guy.
Well, thank you, Dave.
I can't bring dates to see you anymore, because they don't want to leave with me.
Well, that's okay. You just bring them.
Yeah,
bring them.
You'll take them, huh?
We can all go out.
But, so you signed with Columbia. And of course, you scored with a whole bunch of hits at Columbia, from, you know, Don't You Care. I guess that was the next follow-up to Kind of a Drag.
Follow-up, yeah.
And then you went on to cover a song that, of course, that I always loved, even by the original guys, Larry Williams and Johnny Guitar Watson. I guess the original vocal, I should say. I guess the original might have been, Cannonball Adderley, perhaps.
Cannonball Adderley, yeah. But, Mercy Mercy was an album cut. And when we were looking for material, you know, at Columbia, you're always getting sent. Once you're on the charts, you're getting sent material all the time. While we were doing the first Columbia album, Time and Charges, we got sent from Johnny Guitar Watson the demo of Mercy Mercy that him and Larry Williams did. It's the same song that's on their CD. That's on the album that they did together, and that was the demo he sent us. And Marty Greb and I immediately glommed on to it because we enjoyed singing together, and so it was really cool that we did that song as an album cut. But then somebody at Columbia said that, you know, they thought that it would be a good single, so they went ahead and they released it, and it became a good hit for us.
Well, let's give it a listen, and we'll talk about it when we come back.
All right.
Like I'm losing my mind. I'm wasting my time. Susan, do you have to be confusing? I ask myself why you're saying goodbye. No other girl could ever take of you. Though you're hurting me, you know I'll always be thinking of you. Girl, I love you.
Yes, Dave the Rave played the wrong song there. But we're gonna listen to Mercy, 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 because I need to get mercy for playing the wrong song, and then we'll find out all about that crazy interlude in the middle of Susan. I have no idea why they put that in there, but here's the Mercy, 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 and then, of course, we'll get back with Dennis Stefano, our guest tonight. Dennis Stefano, of course, the original lead singer of the Buckinghams. Of course, Larry Williams and Johnny Guitar Watson, who of course did that on the OK record label with lyrics. Cannibal Adderley, of course, the instrumental, and then of course the Buckinghams ended up recording that, and it became a hit for them. Mercy, 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 and again, my guest is Dennis Stefano, and I'm glad you guys recorded that. You did a great version of that song, Dennis.
Well, thank you. I mean, it was a lot of fun to do. I mean, I think part of the joy comes through on the record, I think, the fun we had doing it. And then when I do it live today, I have a lot of fun singing that song.
Well,
we're very, very blessed, you know, to have that. I mean, first of all, you got a great melody and a great chord structure song from Joe Zawinul. And then you got Johnny Guitar Watson putting a great lyric to it that fit perfectly. So, you know, we were kind of actually humbled by the fact that we could make a pop song out of an incredibly great jazz song. You know?
And that song was so loved that a guy who many people know him from TV, from the Conan O'Brien TV show, and of course he's a great horn player, trombone player, he even called in from Los Angeles. He's on the phone line. He wants to tell you how much he loves Mercy, Mercy, Mercy. So let's say hello to a real quick...
I love that version. That's so cool. I never heard it.
That is Richie Rosenberg, La Bamba.
Yeah.
Richie, you were asking about the horns on the song, weren't you?
Yeah.
You're on the air live, Richie. Talk to us.
Ricky, are you there? Oh yeah, I'm here. Yeah, there he is. Yeah, I don't really know the the guys that played on it, because we weren't there for the sweetening session, but I know it was L.A. guys. Uh-huh. And because I know that Tom Scott played on a lot of our earlier records as one of the session guys, you know, so I know that it was that era of guys.
Right.
Yeah, but they're all great. Right, so, that was actually one of the songs that actually the Wrecking Crew, but the studio guys in L.A., because Columbia, you know, whenever you were, if it wasn't a single, it was an album cut, they while you were on the road working for like 30 days, they would go in and cut like five sides with the studio guys to speed things up, you know. So on the Mercy Mercy, it's Carol Kay on bass, and it's John Guerin, a great jazz drummer that was with the LA Express. He's playing drums on that one. It's kind of exciting for us because the people that played on that record, that was the only single that the band never did the basic tracks on. All the other singles we played on. So,
right.
Well, listen, feel free to wake up Conan and pick a date. Let us know when you want Dennis Stefano on the Conan O'Brien show, you know.
Man, I wish I had some kind of fool like that on there. Hey, stick to the bone plan, buddy, and we'll come up with a comedy.
Yeah, just tell him that I'm a pretty funny singer when it comes down to it. You know?
And still good looking. Still got the good looks and good moves, too, by the way.
I have a lot of fun. I enjoy what I do, Dave.
Right, I hear you. Well, Richie, thank you. And Richie, I got a song coming up for you in a little bit. You know, Richie's got a show coming up here in New Jersey, although he's based out in L.A. He's got, of course, his big band, which is him, and of course Mark Pender is also on the Conan O'Brien show. And of course they're doing a show, and they're also going to be working behind Darlene Love on the 27th of August down here at the Paramount Theater, I guess, for Convention Hall in Asbury Park.
Cool. So. Well, Richie, that'd be great, man, if we can, you got a big band and stuff, and I do a complete Bobby Darin songbook, so it's like we should go up there and collaborate.
We should talk about that, yeah.
Yeah, that'd be fun. I could stand in front of your guys, hand you out some charts, and we could have some fun.
Cool.
Well, yeah, that'd be great.
Well, Richie,
I'll reach out to you.
Yeah, all right. Richie, I will. Thanks for calling. If you're around for a little bit, listening to the rest of the interview, I'll play. I know there's a song that an old 40. Richie sometimes will come to me and says, "Hey, what's a cool like old obscure rhythm and blues record that my band could do?" And I found some for Richie in the past, and I found an Eddie Bo tune that I think would be great for Richie's band. I'm gonna play that Eddie Bo tune as soon as we finish up the interview with Dennis. So don't go to bed early, Richie.
No, I'm right here.
All right. Well, Richie Rosenberg LaBamba, thanks for calling in, and I'll talk to you a little bit later on.
All right, Dave.
And I'll get you.
All right, Dennis.
All right.
Take care, man.
All right, bye. So, Dennis, that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
It'd be really, really cool also if you end up doing something with Conan O'Brien.
You never know. Just got to keep the window open.
Right. Now, talk about Susan. Okay, I know we talked a little bit off the air about it, but of course, you know, listeners did wonder what were you guys thinking? And of course, it might not have been you. It might have been somebody else from the record label, but how did that mishmash end up in the middle of Susan?
It was an idea that our producer had, and he said, just play 32 bars of Quick Track here and leave it open, and I'm going to put this amazing thing in there, and you guys are going to love it.
And the producer again was who?
The producer was Jim Gersio, who went on to produce Chicago and Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and then kind of got out of the music business after a while. But he produced the record, and he sent us the acetate. We were on the road. I mean, we worked about 200 days a year back then. We were always on the road. And we got the acetate about 3 weeks later when they did the mix. And we were so excited to hear this great thing that he promised us. And we were freaked out. We hated it. It's a beautiful love song about this girl, Susan. And all of a sudden there's a nightmare in the middle of it, you know? And it was really weird. I would say 99.9% of the DJs cut it off. of the song when they were carting them. They would just cut that piece out.
Of course, eventually the Columbia did rush release a DJ copy with that edit where that was taken out.
Oh, yeah, they got a lot of complaints. And the biggest complaint was that if somebody tuned in to the radio station when that section was playing, they went to another station because they didn't know what they were listening to. And so the stations were losing listeners. And so they decided to complain to Columbia, and they did put out a cut-up record of it. So, and we never played it live. We go directly from, you know, where that noise would happen. We go from a drum break into the part, the love part, the acapella part, and it just never made sense to us, you know. And the song Susan was important because Jim Holvey also wrote that song, co-wrote it with Gary Beesberg. But the kind of a drag, don't you? Hey baby, they're playing our song, and Susan are all about the same girl.
Really. And who was Susan?
Susan was a go-go dancer on Rush Street in Chicago, and she dated Jim Holvey for, I don't know, 6-9 months or whatever they dated, and then they broke up, and his heart got broken. And you listen to the songs, it tells the story right there. But it was like when I talked to Jimmy, because I have lunch with him because he's out in L.A. here too. I talked to Jim Holvey all the time, and I said, and he's like, yeah. He says, you know, he says it was really a drag because she was a really good-looking girl, and I really loved her, and, you know, she broke my heart. And I said, yeah, but you're better off. You had 5-hit records. You know, I mean, it's a much better deal.
Right.
The records last forever, you know. But it was interesting because they're all about the same girl. And knowing that, when you listen to the lyrics of each song, you'll hear the same thread go through it. You know, you broke my heart, but I still love you.
And I would have thought after those songs and her, I guess, knowing that those songs were written because of her, I thought that would have brought them together.
Did they get back together? Don't think that happened. No, it didn't happen. Times are tough in romance, you know?
Well, does that mean that in the latter part of the Buckingham's career on Columbia, does that mean that Jim Holvey found another girl? Because, I don't know, did he write Back in Love Again?
No, Marty Greb wrote Back in Love Again. He wrote You Misunderstand Me and Back in Love Again. And those were two singles that we were going to do at the end of our Columbia time. But that was part of the dismemberment of the band. There was some bad blood between us and the producer. We had to take them to court. And during that period of time, Columbia Records got a little disenchanted because of the litigation. He said some things to the company. The company soured on us on some lies that he told them, which then resulted in them backing off of promoting us. So our last two singles just fell down into the gutter, you know.
Now, the producer still being Jim Guercio at the time?
Yes.
So it was Jim Guercio that was getting sued?
Yes, we had to take him to court. There was some financial issues and some publishing issues that we had to deal with that were done behind us, our backs.
Now, some of those later singles, I think the arranger was Jimmy Wisner on some of the later singles.
Well, the last when we were litigating with Guercio, we fired him as our producer, of course, because we were in litigation, and Columbia gave us Jim Wisner to produce our last album. So Jim, he was great actually to work with. The Wiz was great. He introduced us to some new material too that we did on that last album. And we were writing a lot then too. So the last couple of albums we did was a lot of our material that we wrote ourselves. So, Jimmy the Wiz was great. But then things were in such disarray by the end of that. Columbia wasn't behind us anymore, and we didn't want the band to get dragged into the mud, so we disbanded in 1970. Matter of fact, in my show, I always tell people, I said, yeah, the band broke up in 1970, because people ask me all the time, well, why did you leave the band?
Yeah, I was coming up for me as well.
Yeah. They said, why did you leave the band? And I said, well, I never left the band. There was no band to leave. We broke up in 1970. And in the 80s, Carl and Nick and I did a reunion for WLS Radio in Chicago for the Chicago Fest that they had there. And I was a solo act for 12, 15 years after we broke up. So,
well, when you say so, you and Carl did do a recording on old records.
Yeah, in the 70s, we did three albums for Lou Adler.
Right.
Singer-songwriter stuff. Yeah, we did that. And then that wasn't really... We did three pretty decent albums on that one.
Really good albums.
We enjoyed that. That was great working with Lou Adler. I mean, he's quite a special producer. So that worked out good. But then we did this little reunion, and it worked out so well that Carl and Nick said, well, we could do this again. Let's go out and be the Buckinghams again. And I had already invested about 8 to 10 years of being a solo in Los Angeles, and I was doing a lot of acting work and singing work. So I didn't want to put the band back together after 11 years, because I was like interested in the challenge of something new. And so they put the band. I said, well, if you want to do it, go ahead.
So they had your blessing at that point. Is that correct?
Yeah, they had my blessing, and of course we all own the trademark, but the trademark law is usage. So since they used the name and I didn't, then they had ownership of the name, which is fine with me. It doesn't cost me anything to let them have the name. because I really didn't. I'd rather just go out and beat Dennis Stefano and have my solo career. And so everything was fine, but people, because they saw them on the road for the last 30 years now as the Buckinghams, they somehow assumed that I left the band and they continued. But the fact is that they restarted the band up without me because I was already working.
You were doing acting, and if you don't mind, you can mention, I think, some of the things that you were involved with in film. I think you were doing something with Olivia Newton-John too, if I recall.
Oh yeah, in 82, I was Tom Scott called me. He was the musical director for her concert, and he said, Dennis, I'm doing this tour with Olivia, and I really need some background singers, and I also need somebody who can do a couple of duets with her, you know. And I said, really? And he said, yeah, you know, since you've been acting and singing, he says, you probably can handle this. So I went down and I auditioned with Olivia on the song, the Cliff Richard duet, the stuff from Suddenly from Xanadu. So, and it was with her. So I just walked in and really, you know, pretty much put the musical make on her. And we sang together and it clicked. And so we went out and did a three-month tour together, and then we did an HBO special with her with the same concert, and then those video clips live on YouTube constantly now. It's You're the One That I Want from Greece and Suddenly from Xanadu. So yeah, that was a great thing. And that's what I was enjoying doing, was working on special projects as a singer as opposed to just going back and just doing the same thing over and over again. And then in the... I came back singing full blast doing this Bobby Darin tribute show, and meanwhile Carl and Nick were the Buckinghams, and they were doing that out on the road, and so that's how people got the idea that that I left the band. And I said, no, we were a '60s band, so we had to break up in 1970 because okay. We were a '60s band. Like, that's my little story. But actually, Carl and Nick and I and Marty had a reunion last year in Chicago.
We for did a benefit.
For Marty.
Right.
Yeah. And it was the first time in 45 years that the surviving members of the band got together and played. And it was pretty spectacular. It was a lot of fun to do.
Did you walk away? Was there a good feel or a good vibe? Or was it like just a one-night type of thing and, you know...
It was just a one night thing. I mean, people that were at the concert said they would have loved to see, because we had every Chicago band that ever made a record was on this show. So it was like an amazing Chicago jukebox of music. And everybody said they knew that it could never be done again, but it was the most spectacular concert they ever saw, because it was all these hit records from Chicago bands, plus the Buckinghams doing all their hits together. With everybody except John Polis, because he was the leader of the band who put the band together, and the drummer, great drummer, a very underrated drummer. And nowadays, a lot of the drummers that I work with talk about his playing like, amazing drummer that he was. But he passed away in 1979. So he wasn't there. And then 8 months later, PBS called us, and they did a very similar show called Cornerstones of Rock. And so we reunited again. Marty wasn't involved in this one because he was on the road with a band he works with called The Weight. And so we actually reunited again, and they sang a couple of songs on their own, and then I came up and sang three songs on my own. Matter of fact, I opened with I'll Go Crazy. So we get along. I mean, it was a nice experience, but you know, it's one of those kind of things where it's kind of like going back and dating an old girlfriend. Because you get that same old feeling, you know, and you get kind of excited, you get this thing, but it doesn't really it doesn't linger as long anymore because it's you've got other stuff going on in your life. So we had a great time. We'll probably do a couple more shows live for the Cornerstones of Rock thing for PBS. So that means that we'll probably reunite for a couple of gigs if that series goes off. But you know, I think we're all, Carl and Nick are pretty comfortable in their position as being the Buckinghams, and I'm really comfortable being myself. And so I think it's all working out pretty nice. It's a pretty good balance of music.
Are you guys able to share a drink, a beer together?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's good. That's a nice feeling. I mean, you know.
Years ago, there was a little bit of tension because I think they were a little concerned that I was out there singing on my own. Of course, being the voice of the band, doing what I'm doing, and they're doing it, and it kind of... The balance was a little bit off for them, so they were a little bit tenuous about that. But we talked, and then we got together, and we had a couple of good conversations about it, and so everybody would feel comfortable in their own skin, and it worked out fine. You know, I mean, and when we did these reunions, it was great. I mean, we got along really well, and we sounded good. You know, it was nice. It was kind of like getting like an old, great old baseball glove that you really like, put that oil on, you know, and taped it up with the ball inside, and then you put the glove back on, and it just feels like that old glove again. It was really comfortable.
So there's like opportunities to work together. They seem to work out fine, but then there's still the ability to each, you and Carl and Nick, everybody seems to be able to find enough work to make a living.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, they've been doing really well. I think that they're making a better living than the original band did, really. You know, money is a lot better today than it was back then. But they're doing fine, and I'm out there working. I'm grateful as hell because, I mean, I never thought that our music would be lasting this long and that our fans would be so up for everything like it is. So I'm having a ball out there, you know. And the great thing about having people come out to the shows now is that afterwards they have stories connected to the songs, what the songs meant to them and what part of their lives that became important to them. And it's amazing to hear some of the stories. So that's a big part of it now, too. That's, for me, it's one of the big treats of going out and performing live, is getting to sing the songs and still hit it, and then afterwards talk to the people about, you know, what these songs meant to them. And some of it's pretty heavy, you know.
Well, the show is great, Dennis. I sincerely, and I'm a pretty honest guy, I mean, I tell it like it is. And your show, the first time I saw you, I was looking forward to seeing what you were going to sound like and how you looked and everything, but you look great, you sound great, you move great. I mean, anybody going to see Dennis Stefano in concert, you're going to get your money's worth. There's no doubt about that. And I'm honored that we have you. I'm honored that we have you on the show tonight. And again, I want to thank Gary Miller, who was a good impetus for getting this together here tonight. I got two rapid questions for you to conclude our night here. First one may be hard, but let's see how you would give a quick answer. Your favorite Buckingham song is?
Don't You Care.
Don't You Care. And what's your, of the songs that you recorded on and released on singles that didn't make it big, which one of those did you, what's your favorite one that never made like the top 40 or top 50?
That would be Back in Love Again.
Well,
Yeah,
that's probably my favorite as well. And really? I'm going to say it's good to have you back out on the road again, Dennis. And
Well, thank you, Dave. I love what I do, man, and I have a ball doing it. And as long as I'm able to do it, I'll continue to do it.
I'll make sure when you're in my area that I stop and see you and say hello, and I'll look for you on the Conan O'Brien show.
Yeah.
And
you're in the you're New Jersey area?
New Jersey, yeah.
Yeah.
Anything coming up in New Jersey?
Next year I got some things coming up around Dante. Has a couple of gigs asked me to be on, but of course New Jersey is not Staten Island, but there's some things coming up next year that I'll probably be in that area, so I'll definitely connect with you.
Look forward to seeing you, and from your favorite song that didn't make it, that should have made it, to mine, which is the same song as well. We actually talked about that, you and I, once backstage at a venue. But thank you so much for being a part of my Relics and Rarity show. If you want to contact Dennis, best way to contact you is what, through Facebook, Dennis?
Yeah, go to Facebook. It's Dennis Tufano Sings, Facebook/ Dennis Tufano Sings. It's a really good official page. It has videos and pictures and all the music. It's a great little page put together by my good friend Pam Dixon. And that's the best place to go. Also, there's a website called dtsings.com that you can get a lot there too. So keep in touch, and we always list on the both the website and the Facebook page all my gigs and everything, so you can keep up to date with me on that.
Dennis, thanks, and thanks for being a part of tonight, and good luck with the upcoming big gig at Huntington, West Virginia. Give our regards to
Huntington, West Virginia. Get your pizza hands out there.
Right.
Let's go.
The Italian Festival. Dennis, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave. Appreciate it, man.
All right, take care now. Sound of the Buckinghams. Yes, that should have been a big hit. That was a great tune. Buckinghams and Back in Love Again. I'm Dave the Raven. This is my Relics and Rarity show.